A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been thinking about our episodes on logistics and customs, and he's connecting it to something that happened during the recent Iran-Israel conflict. In March, U.S. officials confirmed Israel was running critically low on Iron Dome interceptors after sustained barrages. The fix came from two directions: direct U.S. airlift replenishment, and a quieter transfer from the UAE, which had received Israeli interceptors under Abraham Accords defense cooperation agreements. His question is, when national defense is on the line and you need to move a 90-kilogram, 3-meter-long missile interceptor across an international border in hours, does customs still matter? Does anyone file an Incoterm? Is bureaucracy just ignored? Or is there a whole parallel system?
The short answer is, there's absolutely a system, and in some ways it's more complex than the civilian one, but it's front-loaded. All the bureaucracy happens years in advance so that when the crisis hits, the transfer itself can happen in hours. The Abraham Accords were signed in 2020, but the specific defense cooperation agreements that enabled weapons transfers weren't finalized until 2022 to 2024. That's 4 years of diplomatic and legal groundwork to make a 48-hour transfer possible.
The paperwork isn't gone. It's just been done already, by different people, in a different building.
Exactly the right way to think about it. And the people doing it aren't customs brokers. They're defense attachés, State Department officials, and military lawyers working under frameworks like ITAR, the International Traffic in Arms Regulations, and its Israeli and Emirati equivalents. A commercial importer needs a customs broker, an HS code classification, a commercial invoice, a bill of lading, and usually a duty payment. For a defense transfer, the equivalent is an end-user certificate and a government-to-government sales agreement. But those are negotiated at the diplomatic level, not per shipment.
The missile doesn't go through the green channel at Dubai Customs.
It doesn't even see the customs hall. Military cargo moves under what's called diplomatic clearance or a government bill of lading. The customs declaration is a single-page form, not a 10-page commercial invoice. And the people handling it are military attachés and defense cooperation offices that operate entirely outside the commercial customs system. They have their own lanes, their own airfields in many cases, their own handling protocols.
Which raises the question, does the civilian system even know the transfer happened?
In most cases, no, not in real time. There may be post-facto notifications between governments, but the civilian customs authority at the border is not the entity clearing the shipment. It's cleared at the diplomatic level. The Semaphore report from March confirmed U.S. officials were saying Israel was critically low on interceptors. That's not something you'd find on a commercial shipping manifest. That information moves through defense channels.
Let's back up and look at the actual mechanism here, because I think the Israel-UAE case is a perfect illustration. Israel supplied Iron Dome batteries and interceptors to the UAE in 2024 to 2025 as part of defense cooperation under the Abraham Accords. Then, when Israel faced a shortage in early 2026, the UAE returned or redirected interceptors back. This was confirmed by Yonet News and Jerusalem Post.
What made that possible wasn't goodwill, though that helped. It was a legal framework called a blanket license or government-to-government agreement that pre-clears categories of defense articles for transfer between allied nations. The Abraham Accords created the diplomatic framework, but the specific defense cooperation agreements enabling weapons transfers were separate. They had to specify exactly what could be transferred, under what conditions, with what end-use monitoring.
End-use monitoring. That sounds like the kind of thing that keeps defense attachés up at night.
It's the central tension in all of this. When you transfer a weapons system to an ally, you need to verify it's being used for the purpose you agreed to and not being re-exported to someone else. In the Israel-UAE case, the Jinza Report, that's the Jewish Institute for National Security of America, explicitly documented Iron Dome deployment to the UAE as proof of Abraham Accord's defense potential. They were making the case that this kind of pre-positioning creates strategic depth, but every one of those interceptors had to be tracked. When the UAE sent them back to Israel, Israeli and Emirati defense attachés physically verified the cargo at both departure and arrival.
There's a physical inspection. It's not just a handshake and a good luck with the incoming missiles.
Far from it. And this is where the misconception comes in. People think military logistics just ignores paperwork. It doesn't. It uses a parallel, pre-negotiated system that requires years of groundwork. The Abraham Accords took 4 years to operationalize for weapons transfers. Every transfer under that framework requires specific government-to-government agreements. The difference is that once those agreements are in place, the per-shipment friction drops to nearly zero.
The civilian equivalent would be something like authorized economic operator programs or trusted trader schemes, where you do the compliance work up front at the relationship level, not per shipment.
That's exactly the right analogy. And the military model shows just how much friction you can remove by investing in relationship-level compliance. A civilian importer doing a one-off shipment might spend days on customs documentation. A pre-cleared defense partner can move a missile interceptor in hours because all the classification, all the licensing, all the in-use verification was resolved years ago.
Let's talk about the U.S. role in this, because it was happening simultaneously. The U.S. was supplying Israel directly under Foreign Military Sales, FMS, and using something called Emergency Drawdown Authority.
And that's a separate pipeline with its own streamlined customs bypass. The U.S. Defense Logistics Agency has pre-positioned stocks and the legal authority to release them without going through the normal congressional notification process during an emergency. During the March 2026 crisis, the U.S. was airlifting interceptors on C-17s while the UAE transfer was happening through a completely different channel. Two parallel military supply chains, both bypassing commercial customs, both operating under pre-negotiated legal frameworks.
Which brings us to the cost question. Daniel mentioned air freight being prohibitively expensive for most commercial shipments. I assume nobody was running a cost-benefit analysis on the C-17 flights.
The metric shifts entirely. In civilian logistics, you're optimizing for cost per kilogram or cost per unit shipped. In emergency military logistics, the metric is time to defensive capability. The question isn't, what does it cost to fly this interceptor from Qatar to Tel Aviv? The question is, how many people die if it arrives tomorrow instead of today?
Cost becomes effectively infinite, or at least not the binding constraint.
Which creates a fascinating second-order problem. When cost is no object, the constraint shifts to availability. There are only so many C-17s, only so many cargo aircraft certified to carry munitions, only so many airfields with the right handling equipment. A single Tamir interceptor weighs about 90 kilograms and is roughly 3 meters long. It requires temperature-controlled storage, between 15 and 25 degrees Celsius, and must be handled by personnel with explosive ordnance clearance. You can't just toss it in a cargo hold next to someone's checked luggage.
The constraint isn't budget. It's airframes, certified personnel, and compatible infrastructure.
Those are much harder to scale quickly than money. You can authorize emergency spending in an hour. You can't build a new C-17 or train an ordnance handler in an hour. The U.S. Defense Logistics Agency manages this by maintaining war reserve stockpiles pre-positioned in allied nations, so the interceptors are already geographically close to where they'll be needed. The Israel-UAE arrangement is essentially an emulation of that model under the Abraham Accords framework.
The UAE having interceptors to send back implies a pre-planned stockpile arrangement. It's a form of distributed inventory, allies holding each other's spare capacity.
And the Jinza report documented this explicitly. Iron Dome deployment to the UAE was designed to test this concept. Can we pre-position defensive systems with an ally under a legal framework that allows rapid return transfer if needed? The 2026 crisis was the proof of concept.
Let's talk about what happens inside the country receiving the emergency shipment. Daniel asked whether bureaucracy and inventory management is just ignored temporarily while people focus on the bigger picture.
It's not ignored. It switches to a different system. During the 2026 conflict, Israel's Ministry of Defense activated emergency procurement protocols. These bypass the standard tender process. Normally, if the military needs more interceptors, they issue a tender, Rafael and maybe other contractors bid, there's a review process, a contract is awarded. That can take months. Under emergency protocols, the ministry can contract directly with Rafael, essentially saying, we need everything you can produce, starting now, we'll sort out the payment later.
Which I imagine Rafael is fine with, since they're the only manufacturer and the country is under attack.
It helps that they're a domestic manufacturer, yes, but the same principle applies to international transfers. The emergency protocols pre-authorize certain actions, direct contracting, expedited customs, priority airfield access, so that when the crisis hits, nobody is waiting for a signature.
This is the front-loaded bureaucracy concept again. The emergency isn't when you figure out the process. The emergency is when you activate a process you already designed.
That's the key insight for anyone who thinks about supply chains for a living. The military doesn't have less bureaucracy. It has different bureaucracy applied at a different time. The Abraham Accords, the ITAR exemptions, the FMS agreements, the emergency procurement protocols, these are all bureaucratic artifacts. They're just artifacts designed to compress decision-making into hours rather than months.
Let's get concrete about what actually moves. The Tamiya Interceptor. 90 kilograms, 3 meters long, temperature-sensitive, explosive ordnance. What does it actually take to put one of these on a plane?
First, you need an aircraft certified for munitions transport. Not every military cargo plane qualifies. You need specific fire suppression systems, specific tie-down configurations, specific crew training. Second, the interceptor itself has to be in a certified transport container with temperature monitoring. Third, the loading has to be supervised by personnel with explosive ordnance clearance. They verify the interceptor is safe, properly secured, and compatible with everything else in the cargo hold.
This is per interceptor?
Per pallet, typically. Multiple interceptors can be loaded together if they're properly configured. But the handling requirements don't scale down. Even one interceptor requires the same certified personnel and the same documentation.
Which means there's a minimum viable shipment size that makes sense. You're not going to fly a C-17 across the Middle East for one interceptor.
Right, though in an extreme emergency you might. But the practical reality is that these transfers happen in batches. The UAE didn't send one interceptor back to Israel. They sent a meaningful quantity that justified the logistical effort. The US airlift was the same. Pallets of interceptors, not individual units.
Let's talk about the paperwork that does exist at the point of transfer. You mentioned the single-page customs declaration. What's actually on that page?
Typically, it identifies the cargo by broad category. Defense articles under agreement reference number such and such, rather than itemizing individual interceptors. It names the sending and receiving governments, the diplomatic authorization, and the point of origin and destination. It does not include a commercial value, because there isn't one in the traditional sense. The transfer happens under a government-to-government agreement that may involve cost reimbursement, but that's handled through separate financial channels, not at the customs point.
No one is standing on the tarmac with a credit card terminal.
The image of a defense attaché swiping a card for 300 interceptors is genuinely delightful, but no. The financial settlement happens between finance ministries, often months later. During the crisis itself, the priority is getting the hardware where it needs to be.
What about Incoterms? Daniel specifically asked whether anyone files an Incoterm for a missile transfer.
They don't. Incoterms are a creation of the International Chamber of Commerce, designed for commercial transactions. Governments use delivery terms defined in the specific government-to-government agreement. For the Israel-UAE transfer, the terms would have been something like X Works Rafael Factory, delivered to UAE Airbase with Israeli Defense Attaché Escort. That specifies who bears risk at each stage, who arranges transport, who handles insurance. The same questions Incoterms answer, but in a completely separate legal framework.
It's a parallel universe that solves the same problems with different vocabulary.
Incoterms assume a buyer and a seller with competing interests. Government-to-government defense agreements assume aligned interests. Both parties want the interceptors to arrive safely and quickly. The adversarial element of commercial terms doesn't apply.
Which probably simplifies things considerably.
in some ways. In other ways, it adds complexity, because the agreements have to anticipate scenarios that commercial contracts don't. What happens if the receiving country is no longer an ally by the time the shipment arrives? What happens if the sending country needs the interceptors back? That's exactly what happened with the UAE transfer. The agreements had to contemplate return transfer before it was needed.
The lawyers who drafted those agreements in 2022 were essentially writing a script for a crisis they hoped would never happen.
The crisis followed their script. That's the quiet triumph of military logistics. When it works, nobody notices. The interceptors arrived, the Iron Dome batteries kept firing, and the story only emerged months later. The Annette News and Jerusalem Post reports about UAE cooperation came out after the conflict, because during the conflict, operational security meant nobody was talking about where the interceptors were coming from.
Let's shift to the physical infrastructure side. You mentioned pre-positioned stockpiles. Where are these things actually stored?
The U.S. model is instructive. The Defense Logistics Agency maintains war reserve stockpiles in allied nations, Israel, South Korea, several NATO countries. These are warehouses full of munitions, spare parts, medical supplies, everything you'd need to sustain a military operation for a defined period. The stockpiles are owned by the U.S., but stored on allied soil under status of forces agreements. In a crisis, they can be released to the host nation under pre-authorized drawdown authority.
The UAE arrangement is a variation on that. Israel pre-positions interceptors with an ally, under an agreement that allows rapid return.
It's a more distributed model. Instead of one big warehouse in one country, you have smaller stockpiles across multiple allies. The advantage is geographic diversity. If one stockpile is compromised, others are still available. The disadvantage is complexity. You need agreements with each host nation, and the legal framework has to be compatible across all of them.
Which is where the Abraham Accords come in. They created a multilateral framework that made bilateral stockpile agreements easier to negotiate.
The Accords were the diplomatic umbrella. The Defense Cooperation Agreements were the specific implementing documents. And the Jinza report was essentially arguing, this framework works, look at what it enabled. The Iron Dome deployment to the UAE wasn't just about defending the UAE, it was about creating strategic depth for Israel through distributed inventory.
We've covered the legal framework, the cost dynamics, the physical handling, the inventory management shift. What haven't we talked about?
The human element. All of these systems depend on people who know each other. The Israeli defense attaché in Abu Dhabi, the Emirati counterpart in Tel Aviv, these relationships were built over years. When the crisis hit, they weren't introducing themselves over email. They were picking up the phone to people they'd been working with since the accords were signed.
Which is something civilian supply chain professionals will recognize immediately. The best logistics system in the world doesn't help if you don't know who to call.
The military invests heavily in those relationships. Defense attachés are senior officers whose entire job is maintaining relationships with their counterparts in allied nations. They're not processing paperwork. They're building the trust that makes the paperwork when it matters.
The system is simultaneously more flexible and more rigid than civilian logistics. More flexible because cost is no object and partners are pre-cleared. More rigid because only certain aircraft can carry munitions, only certified personnel can handle them, and end-use monitoring is strict.
That's the paradox. And it's why you can't just apply military logistics methods to civilian supply chains. The constraints are different. A commercial shipper can use any aircraft, any carrier, any route. A military shipper has a much narrower set of options, but within that set, they can move with extraordinary speed.
Which brings us to the question Daniel was really asking, I think. What can a civilian supply chain professional learn from all of this?
First, the concept of front-loaded compliance. The military spends years negotiating agreements so that individual shipments clear in hours. The civilian equivalent is programs like Authorized Economic Operator Status or Trusted Trader Schemes. Invest in relationship-level compliance, and your per-shipment friction drops dramatically. Second, the concept of distributed inventory with pre-cleared partners. If you have agreements in place with trusted suppliers or allied companies, you can hold each other's spare capacity and move it quickly when needed.
The Abraham Accords model, but for widgets instead of missile interceptors.
The stakes are lower, but the principle is the same. Know your partners, pre-negotiate your terms, and when the crisis hits, you're not starting from zero.
Let's talk about what comes next. The Israel-UAE interceptor transfer worked because the crisis unfolded over weeks, not minutes. What happens when the timeline compresses further?
This is where things get interesting. Hypersonic weapons and drone swarms are compressing response times from hours to minutes. Even the current military logistics system, as streamlined as it is, can't move physical interceptors fast enough to respond to a hypersonic attack detected minutes before impact. The next frontier is what some are calling on-call manufacturing, producing interceptors or components near the point of need rather than shipping them from a central stockpile.
Three-dimensional printing of missile components.
Rafael is already exploring this for Tamir components. The idea is that instead of pre-positioning finished interceptors in the UAE, you pre-position manufacturing capability, printers, raw materials, technical specifications, and produce interceptors on demand. You still need the legal framework, you still need the certified personnel, but the physical supply chain becomes dramatically shorter.
Which would make the Abraham Accords framework even more valuable. Because you need the diplomatic and legal infrastructure to share manufacturing specifications across borders.
The front-loaded bureaucracy becomes even more important. You're not just pre-clearing the transfer of finished weapons, you're pre-clearing the transfer of manufacturing capability, which is even more sensitive from an export control perspective.
The future of military logistics is probably more paperwork up front, not less.
Faster transfers when it counts. The pattern holds. Invest in the relationship and the legal framework, and the operational speed follows.
This has been a fascinating deep dive. The core insight, I think, is that military logistics doesn't eliminate bureaucracy. It front-loads it. The Abraham Accords, the ITAR exemptions, the FMS agreements, the emergency procurement protocols. These are years of legal work that enable hours-long transfers. The March 2026 interceptor transfer from the UAE succeeded because of groundwork laid between 2020 and 2024.
For anyone who works in supply chains, the practical takeaway is that relationship-level compliance, authorized economic operator programs, trusted trader schemes, pre-negotiated partner agreements can remove enormous per-shipment friction. The military model shows what's possible when you invest in the framework rather than fighting the paperwork on every shipment.
The Incoterms question turns out to be revealing in exactly the way Daniel suspected. Governments don't use Incoterms at all. They use delivery terms defined in government-to-government agreements. Same questions, different vocabulary, completely separate legal universe. And those two universes are designed to be incompatible, which is probably a feature, not a bug.
The open question for listeners. As defense supply chains become more networked through agreements like the Abraham Accords, AUKUS, and NATO stockpile sharing, will we see any convergence between military and civilian customs systems? The UAE transfer suggests not. These systems are built on different assumptions, different legal frameworks, and different incentives. They'll probably remain parallel universes.
No, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The Bay of Fundy's tidal bore reverses the flow of the Pititicodiac River twice daily, moving roughly 14 billion tons of water per cycle, equivalent to the annual flow of every river on Earth compressed into 12 hours, which means in a single day the bay moves more water than the Amazon discharges in 4 years.
Right. If you want to go deeper on this topic, look up the U.S. Defense Logistics Agency's War Reserve Stockpile Program, or read the Genza report on Iron Dome in the UAE. And if you enjoyed this episode, rate us 5 stars and tell a friend who works in logistics.
This has been My Weird Prompts. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. We'll catch you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu, it's
your head. Send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird props, that's the close from sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird props, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.